Welcome to NPR's movie podcast, a look back at the week that was in movies. This week, a story of survival in the Andes, a generic opera on film, and an interview with the director of a film about an unlikely millionaire. But first, a tribute to Japanese film director Akira Kurosawa.
Many of the most successful American directors cite him as an influence, including George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, and Martin Scorsese. Kurosawa's best-known films are The Seven Samurai and Rashomon. Now the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has restored that 1951 film and organized an exhibition of the filmmaker's artwork. Iris Mann has our story.
Filmmaker Akira Kurosawa brought Japanese movies to an international audience, says fellow director Martin Scorsese.
He was an emissary of Eastern cinema here in the West. He made it possible and also enticing to see these films from another culture, particularly after World War II. And at the same time, he sort of straddled both cultures in a way because it was a revision of the Japan of pre-1940, pre-1945. He was dealing with the modern world in a way, even in approaching his historical subjects.
Scorsese's Film Foundation helped sponsor the restoration of Rashomon, perhaps Kurosawa's most famous work. The movie is set in feudal Japan and depicts four different versions of a rape and murder. Rashomon's restoration was overseen by Michael Pogorzelski, director of the Academy Film Archive. He says he could only find two usable prints and that virtually every shot was damaged by scratches, dirt, or blurring. Pogorzelski says they used advanced digital technology to restore the film. But as he watched the movie again and again, he found himself overwhelmed by its examination of truth and memory.
Watching Rashomon makes you think about your own ego, the role that egoism plays in the way that you tell stories or look at life or think about how people look at you. I mean, even the story of this restoration of the work that we did, if you asked any of the other people involved in it, depending on their role, there's a completely different story of how it happened, of what happened, of what we did. I mean, that's true for all of our lives. And this film really summarizes that in a very moving, lyrical, beautiful way.
All of Kurosawa's films draw you in because they deal with big issues, says Ellen Harrington, the Motion Picture Academy's director of exhibitions and special events.
His films are very moral in an interesting way. He really takes on topics of corruption and greed and love and human destruction and fantasy and passion and emotion in a way that really stands head and shoulders above most filmmakers of any country.
Kurosawa often drew his plots from Shakespeare, Dostoevsky, and other Western sources. Producer Tom Luddy worked with the director in the 1980s, and he was at the kickoff for the Kurosawa tribute.
He was very Japanese, but he grew up as a kind of left-wing man immersed in Russian culture and literature in the 30s, and he was influenced very much by American cinema, John Ford and Westerns, and he had this great mixture of kind of a Russian sensibility married with an American sense for action and imminent violence in films and Japanese-ness. You know, he had this mixture of all the cultures.
Director Martin Scorsese says Kurosawa's films have as much to do with visual art.
They're like giant paintings that move, and they have that epic sweep about them.
In 1990, Scorsese made an appearance as Van Gogh in Kurosawa's film Dreams. He remembers that the director would communicate what he wanted from the cast and crew by showing them his renderings of specific scenes. The Motion Picture Academy is exhibiting more than 100 of these paintings and drawings, together with a variety of materials from Kurosawa's career.
He designed costumes. If you see the paintings, you'll see that it's very tactile. The images are raised almost, in a way, from the paper. And the use of color is extraordinary. And these are very, very clear images that you see painted by him, and you could find the exact frames in his pictures, the way the sky looks at night or daytime, the sun, all of this. It's a wonderful expression on the paintings, I think.
Those moving pictures were the result of a very rigid, precise hand, says Scorsese. Some called Kurosawa Tenno, the Japanese term for emperor. But his son, Hisao, speaking through a translator, says the director was only trying to get the most out of his actors and crew. That's why he insisted on making sure that closets were filled with clothes and drawers with the objects a character might use.
彼はその完全主義っていうことは I know people, even now, say that my father was a perfectionist. But to me, I believe he didn't think he was a perfectionist, or even he didn't think he was the emperor. But what I think is that he just noticed that the other directors never noticed. And he just tried to do all the detailed stuff. So maybe for my father, he's just doing what he's supposed to do.
Kurosawa's approach may have hurt his career. After the Japanese studio system collapsed in the mid-1960s, the director found it hard to get financing, and he attempted suicide. Two high-powered American fans, George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola, pitched in to help. Kurosawa later went on to make some of his most acclaimed films, including Ran, based on King Lear.
I got that sense from him that once he got his footing again, once he pulled himself back together, he was going to get back in that ring and start punching.
Today, director Martin Scorsese is lending his support and trying to interest young audiences in the relevance of Kurosawa's films.
Talking this way hopefully might have a few young people get some of the DVDs and see some of his pictures. We have to show them this because it's there. I mean, it's there in the films. And so in a way, we have to make these pictures relevant in a way to the younger people, let them know they're out there, open them, open their mind's eye and their heart to these type of films.
Director Martin Scorsese. Akira Kurosawa died in 1998. According to his son, some 30,000 people attended his funeral. For NPR News, I'm Iris Mann.
You can watch a scene from Rashomon and look at some of those Kurosawa scene sketches at npr.org.
The snowy mountains of the Andes figure in a new documentary film, Stranded. I've Come From a Plane That Crashed on the Mountains has an amazing story to go along with its long title. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan has this review.
Stranded is an exceptional film. It tells one of the 20th century's best-known tales of survival and shows that we haven't really known it at all. Who hasn't heard the story of the Uruguayan airliner that slammed into the Andes in 1972? Who doesn't know about the 16 young men who survived for 72 days because they did the unthinkable and ate the flesh of those who died? Their story, under the title Alive, became both an internationally best-selling book and a Hollywood movie starring Ethan Hawke.
And when she's dead, I'm gonna climb out of these goddamn mountains. Back to my father. Back to my room in my house.
How are you gonna do that?
I'd freeze to death.
Not if I wore enough clothes, I wouldn't. You'd starve to death.
Nando, you can't climb a mountain on a little piece of chocolate and a sip of wine.
Well, then I'll cut some meat off the pilots.
But it is only now, some 35 years after the fact, that the people who made it out alive agreed to talk on camera with breathtaking candor about what they went through.
Estamos jugados, totalmente jugados.
Vamos a otro paso y a seguir y a marchar.
These stories do not shortchange the horror of the situation, but out of disaster can come the purity of transcendence. The survivor's experience turns out to have been a surprisingly spiritual one, a story of near reincarnation and intimate religious communion. One reason these men felt safe unburdening themselves was that the director, Gonzalo Arijon, was also a boyhood friend. He has added several things to the compelling interviews, including a delicate score and haunting, dreamlike recreations that heightened the drama. Roberto Canessa, one of the two men who walked out of the Andes to save the group, was at Stranded Sundance premiere, and it's no exaggeration to say that what he experienced turned him into a figure of enormous charisma. Asked to reflect on it all, he replied quietly, "Make plans for 100 years. But you must be ready to die at any moment." Words to live by, and a film impossible to forget.
The movie is Stranded. Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times, and you can see clips from Stranded and find more reviews of this week's new movies at npr.org.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show is the ultimate cult movie. It bombed at the box office when it came out in 1975, but a fan base quickly developed around its campy music and its characters. In some places, even today, you can go and see the Rocky Horror Picture Show every weekend, if that's your kind of thing. Now, another movie is vying to become the next cult classic, as Beth Accomando of member station KPBS reports.
When Darren Lynn Bousman decided to make Repo the genetic opera, he sensed the cult potential in its distinctive retro-future goth story.
In the future, people can buy and sell organs on credit, and if you buy a heart, you can buy a heart. However, if you miss a payment and you're not able to afford that heart, it is complete responsibility of the provider to repossess that organ.
Say that you once bought a heart or new corneas, but somehow never managed to square away your debts. He won't bother to write or to phone you. He'll just rip the still-beating heart from your chest!
Bousman wanted to tap into an underserved audience, just as Rocky Horror Picture Show had done three decades ago.
They are the what I was when I was growing up in high school, the outcast, the freaks, the alternative, the fringe. And that's a huge, huge, huge market.
But engineering a cult hit is difficult to do. David Glanzer is marketing director for Comic-Con International, where many films have tried to assert their cult worthiness. But Glanzer says, if you look at the Rocky Horror Picture Show, it initially failed at the box office, and then fans turned it into a cult phenomenon.
And it was so far out there that it was cool to be associated with that. Can you go in there with the intention of creating what's cool? That's a tough one.
But it's a very different environment now than it was in 1975 when the Rocky Horror Picture Show came out. Now, the internet provides a powerful but still unpredictable marketing tool for filmmakers. Bousman has embraced the internet because it costs him nothing but his time.
Every single night, myself and the creators are on the website in the chat rooms talking to the fans, planning little stunts, you know, figuring out what we can do as a grassroots effort to get the movie out there. And so I think the fans feel a part of something because think about it. You're talking to the director, the lead actor, and the composer of the movie on a nightly basis on this website saying, okay, everyone print out 10 flyers and go to 10 different locations and convert 10 strangers.
Beyond building a fan base, Bousman says you need three things to make a cult film, beginning with a sense of camp.
And I think that, you know, that helps with any cult film, is that you have to be able to know it's okay to make fun of yourselves. And we make fun of ourselves in Repo. And I think that number one. Number two is I think that we haven't commercialized the movie. And I think that's the other thing for a cult. You can't commercialize the movie. And number three, I mean, I think the other thing is just the casting of the movie. The casting is just so weird and out there and, again, non-commercial that I think that helps it.
The diverse cast of Repo features Alexa Vega from Spy Kids, Broadway star Sarah Brightman, award-winning actor Paul Sorvino, Anthony Stewart Head from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Paris Hilton. But what ultimately makes or breaks a cult film is fans. Ravenous, devoted fans.
If you go to see Rocky Horror Picture Show at midnight on Saturday night, you're not watching a movie, you're watching an event. And you show up there and people are dressed in outfits and you have all this diverse group of people in a theater having fun. And there is a sense of community around the showing.
Bousman hopes to be building that community as Repo the Genetic Opera opens this weekend. For NPR News, this is Beth Accomando.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. British film director Danny Boyle is probably best known for 28 Days Later, a post-apocalyptic tale about a virus that leaves infected survivors attacking the uninfected, and Trainspotting, the story of heroin addicts in Edinburgh, Scotland. Boyle also directed Millions, an endearing children's fable, and the films Sunshine, The Beach, and Shallow Grave. Boyle's new film, Slumdog Millionaire, is set in India. It won the People's Choice Award at this year's Toronto Film Festival. It's the story of an orphan boy, Jamal, from a Mumbai slum, who grows up and becomes a contestant on the Indian version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. In this scene, Jamal, played by Dev Patel, has just correctly answered a question from the host, played by Bollywood star Anil Kapoor.
You're absolutely right!
It's getting hot in here.
Are you nervous?
What? Am I nervous? It's you who's in the hot seat, my friend.
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
Bloody hell, he's got prey on the run.
Finally.
A few hours ago,
you were giving chai for the Phoonwallahs, and now you're richer than they will ever be. Walla player. Ladies and gentlemen, what a player!
Because Jamal does so well on the show, he's arrested on suspicion of cheating. His interrogation by the police reveals his remarkable story of escaping Mumbai slums and making his way in a rapidly changing India. Danny Boyle spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Danny Boyle, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, this film kind of just grabs you by the collar early on with this opening. I guess it's the opening scene or an early scene in which you see some slum kids playing kind of a makeshift game of cricket on, I guess, what looks like an airport tarmac. And the security guards come and say, you know, private land, get out of here. And they chase them into this shanty town. And there's this scene that I don't know how long it takes, but it is the most amazing look at this massive sprawling slum, and it includes aerial shots and chases through various places. I want to talk a little bit about it. It just gets you into this city in a way that is just visceral. Talk a little bit about that scene.
That was the whole idea, really, was because we thought, you know, as Westerners going there, cause we only took like 10 crew. The rest of the crew are drawn from Bollywood. But I thought as a Westerner going there and trying to make a film about a kid growing up there, that you're just going to have to film the film as subjectively as possible and just literally tip the audience in off the edge of a cliff and just see how you get on. And the way we did that was through this chase sequence at the beginning where you're literally – there's no like wide shots where you go, hello, everybody, this is India. Hello, everybody, this is Mumbai. And, you know, it's actually – so you don't settle people into the film. You just hurtle them into it full pelt. And that's what it's like arriving there. That I remember the first time I arrived, you were just overwhelmed by the sensory experience of the film. And you think, if I don't start moving very, very quickly, I'm just going to be swept away by this, you know. You have to catch up very, very quickly. And so – the idea was to propel the audience into the environment and leave you no choice, really. You're either going to leave the theatre with a migraine or you're going to settle in and start to absorb this extraordinary city, you know?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to get too technical, but when I looked at those chase scenes, and it's very tight quarters because people are crammed together and their makeshift, you know, habitats are all very close. I couldn't imagine getting a sound boom and lighting and all the stuff that goes with the movie set. How did you film it?
With a very small crew. They're very narrow laneways. And obviously, I mean, as you probably know, in any community, a film crew is disruptive. You know, it disrupts the rhythm and access for a community. We were still very disruptive, but we took a small crew and we filmed with very small digital cameras, which allowed us to capture the dynamism of the place, really, as well as actually not disrupt it too much ourselves. And people were very generous and welcoming to us. We filmed in two slums. A small slum by the airport called Juhu and an extraordinary slum, which is a slum of at least 2 million people. Some say it's the biggest slum on earth, called Dharavi. And that, I mean, the chance to film there is obviously visually stunning because you're able to show a world to people that they often just see from a distance and often just with this rather kind of like distancing title of a slum. You know, and it's rather a pejorative word in the way we use it. But in India, it's just it's a location word. It's a geographic word. It just means that's where they live. Because the places inside are full of energy, life, dynamism. They're very organized, cottage industries. They don't have enough resources. There isn't enough sanitation. There isn't running water or not sufficient enough running water. The electricity is intermittent and slightly dangerous. But those things are not their fault. The things that they have responsibility for, they organize amazingly well. And the thing works. And it works so well that it can absorb a film crew, no problem, you know, and let us not only get on with the film, but benefit from their help in making the movie, you know?
The characters in the film initially are presented to us as kids, like little kids, preschool-age kids. And these are tremendous actors, if they are actors. How did you cast those roles, these slum kids?
Well, initially the film was written in English, completely in English. And when we got there, I mean, that was how we raised the money from. We raised the money from Pathé in Europe and from Warner Brothers in America. But when we got there, it was clear that the seven-year-olds, because they're 7 years old, really, 6 and 7 years old, the kids, they didn't really speak English that comfortably. A lot of the people that speak English very well there, as you see in the rest of the film, and it's quite easy to present the film in English because it's a natural part of life there to speak English. But the little ones hadn't picked it up fully yet, and so it felt a bit stilted and a bit awkward. And the casting director, Loveleen Tandon, she said, listen, if you want to make that work, you need to translate that into Hindi. She said, I know you can't because of your deal and, you know, the reception of the film in the West, but if you want the film to come alive, translate it into Hindi. So we took a deep breath, translated it into the native language, and it just came alive, the kids. Suddenly, these kids from the slums who we could, you know, you saw when you were going around, we could start auditioning them as well. And the electricity just jumped off the rehearsal room, you know, where we were auditioning.
Well, you know, you mentioned that you, you know, you took these digital cameras into this, you know, these slums and shot these scenes. And you used these kids, you know, from those communities. Did people ever regard you as exploiting them? And did you ever feel that tension yourself?
It's an obvious thing that you're very conscious of going in there. And I'd been very lucky. I'd made another film with kids in the UK called Millions, ironically. And I'd been introduced there to the rules and regulations of working with kids in the United Kingdom. And I believe they're very similar to the United States. They're very restrictive. You only can do a few hours with them. And what we did is, because we knew those regulations didn't exist there, we took our regulations with us and we self-imposed them, really, to make sure that we didn't exploit the kids.
I guess I meant it more broadly. I mean, more that you're, you know, Westerners with, you know, money and resources coming and into a community of incredible poverty and sort of capturing it for your own benefit. I mean, did it feel uncomfortable?
In theory, that's the case. I kind of like went into it in an almost naive way, really. It felt, the first time I went there, the first time you go is you go to check the script that it's truthful and believable what you're, and I'm very conscious of that, that it has to meet that question, it has to meet that test, really. And it felt like it was born of true experiences. It felt like it didn't flatter to deceive, that it wasn't exploitative in terms of, you know, trying to use people for ease and easy emotions. It felt like it was a truthful depiction of a city and of a character, really. So given that you're always exploiting people in every film you ever do, given that that happens anyway, per se, just because you're making a film, it felt reasonable what we were asking people to do, and that provided that we took back a picture of us that was really complex and multifaceted, because the city is impossible to define by one person. You just cannot do the definitive picture about the place. But if you can capture a bit of it, and you do it, you include enough of the experiences that you see there, you'll have a reasonable picture of a reasonably truthful picture of an incredibly complex society, really.
Well, Danny Boyle, I guess we're out of time. I wish we could talk some more, but thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Dave.
Danny Boyle directed the new film Slumdog Millionaire. It opened in select cities today and opens wider next week. Boyle spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.